play by Oscar again. This is Neymar. Stop it. Beat it. Lift up from Brazil. Neymar has got the goal. And they're on terms.
Hello and welcome to Only Fools and Football. Which we hope is your favourite podcast. I'm joined by Josh Lawless and Aaron Sohow. How are you boys?
Superb.
I'm very well, although the lack of football is upsetting me.
It is, of course, Friday. The group stages are finished and the round of 16 start tomorrow. Colombia face Uruguay and Brazil face Chile. Which one of those are you looking forward to most, Aaron?
It's got to be... Oh, it's a tough one, actually. Because Brazil and Chile have played very well so far, and I think the whole thing with the Suarez thing has got everyone rooting for Colombia. So it's going to be interesting for whichever games you try and choose. But if I had to choose, I'd say Colombia Uruguay.
Sorry, start you off on a tough one, but Josh, your choice.
I'm going to have to go with Brazil Chile. I think there's a nice blend of styles there. Brazil have their outlet in Neymar, who's I think's been tremendous so far. But you know, Chile, we've seen there what they're capable of, an aggressive, really high intensity and energy sort of game that they play. So I think it's going to be quite a fascinating game. So I'm excited for that one.
Yeah, both will be very good fixtures. Luckily, they're not at the same time like the last few games.
That was dreadful.
Yeah, I know. You got to watch one on stream and one on the TV. It's poor. But let's start off. This isn't really about future fixtures. We'll come to that at the end. It is about the group stages and much controversy with Suarez. So let's start off with him. Firstly, is the ban long enough? Aaron, you're first.
No. But when it happened, I remember... I was actually watching it as it happened, and it was a bit surreal, because even though he's done it before, you sort of want to hope that he's not done it again. And when you watch the replays, it's obviously stupid. It's silly. It's beyond, you know, comprehensible. I said straight away, minimum 9 months. I would have given. Other people have been given bans similar for probably lesser things. I always use Rio Ferdinand's 8-month ban as a barometer. He only missed a drugs test. Suarez has been an appointment for the third time. 9 months, I think, would have been sufficient, which is more or less an entire season. And that would have probably really hurt him. But 4 months, I think, is a bit weak, and I think they don't want to upset people. But it looks like Liverpool and the Uruguayan FA are going to appeal. So it'll probably get shortened even more. But I think it was too short.
Yeah, it's very controversial, because Liverpool fans, of course, aren't happy because he hasn't done it for them. But he has previously done it for them. He has been reportedly racist. He was sort of half-proofed innocent for that. Got an 8-match ban, but... He still claims his innocence. And he's spat on people, he's bitten people. And there's obviously something wrong with him. Josh, 4 months is long enough, maybe not from a United fan. Maybe we're slightly biased because of the whole Evra incident.
I don't think it is sufficient. I mean, maybe if it was the first time that he's done such an act, obviously he's done it once for Ajax, and then with the Ivanovic incident, and now for a third time, and you can never really accept anything like that, but now it's beyond disgraceful, really. And I think maybe if you're looking at what he's actually done, biting an opponent is just out of this world. So for me, it's nowhere near feasible punishment. Maybe, like Karen said, something towards along the lines of 9 months might have been a bit more well, severe punishment, but fairer, in my view.
Yeah, well, Cantona was banned for 9 months, and that was back when football was obviously a more sort of violent place with tackles going in from like all around the pitch, all over your legs. But do you think that, I mean, if you compare this with like a business as football now is, my brother was saying earlier, like if a business director like is jailed or something, it hurts the business indirectly, but it's not like you can just give the business what they want because it's not their fault. The business director is underneath, they have employed them, so they should be responsible for if they hurt the business or not. Is that a fair analogy?
It is, because if you think about it, Liverpool pays wages, and he has done this for a third time. You know, and if we want to talk about any other workplace, it usually would be three strikes and you're out. Liverpool probably have enough grounds if they really, really wanted to, which they won't, but if they really wanted to, they could sack him. I remember when Adrian Mutu was done for cocaine, Chelsea swiftly sacked him. I know that's not to that scale, but he's in front of a worldwide audience, beaten another opponent. He's already had past history. He shouldn't be judged on that with this incident in terms of, because it should be an isolated incident always, but you can't help but think he's done it before. And I think Liverpool are doing their best in terms of trying to appease fans as well as trying to save face as much as anything. But if I was Brendan Rodgers or Ian Eyre at Liverpool, I would be quite, I would be torn to understand what to do, because your head tells you one thing and your heart tells you another. But it is a difficult position for them, and I do feel sorry for the club actually, because they shouldn't be put in that position, because they've supported him too many times, I think. But he's not helped them one bit.
Yeah, I sort of feel sorry for Liverpool, but as a United fan, it's hard to completely do so. And I'm sorry to keep bringing this back to the Cantona fly kicker against the Palace fan, but when he was banned for 9 months, United then took their own action with fining him, and since then, after that incident and United's fine against him, he really, really turned a corner, and you didn't really see him going with that violent streak anymore. Do you think Liverpool, they've backed him up a lot now, and if they were to keep him, which I can't see them doing, because they are they're one of those clubs that, despite despising them, you respect for their usual fair play and like the history of the football club. Do you think this is a turning point? And even if they do keep him, do you think they need to make some sort of statement that they are still one of those clubs, and really that they won't accept this? Josh, what do you think of that?
It looks bad on them if they don't. Obviously, they heavily supported him when there was the old racist allegation claims with Evra, which, you know, he did admit to, you know, saying something. It's just whether the meaning that he meant to say it with. And so they had all the t-shirts and that going on at that time, and after what we deemed to be sort of evidence that he did do it, it looked quite bad on Liverpool. So that, you know, he could have a similar scenario this time, so it'd be useful and in their best interest to come out with some sort of statement and possibly even get him some sort of help, because it's not normal for any footballer to have the intent or the intention of buying another opponent. So, you know, they've got to do something about it.
I think it's the fact he has to try and resort to physical means. I mean, he could do it in other ways in terms of two-footed tackles or trying to injure an opponent, but it's the fact it's the actual thing he's doing, he's biting someone.
Such a vulgar act, isn't it?
Yeah, that's what it is. It's not like a punch or anything like that. It sounds silly, but you can understand if you punch a player or if you kick out at a player or lash out. You know, they're the more natural ways. I mean, if I got angry with somebody, the last thing I would probably think to do is bite them. Mm. So, I mean, don't understand what goes through his head. He does need help. But obviously he was given help before whatever. It's clearly not helped. But I mean, it's just, I mean, going back to Liverpool and what they could do, I think they've dug themselves a really deep grave anyway, because with the racism scandal with Evra, they really did support him to the point where it was a siege mentality, where everybody who from the outside said he should have been punished, whereas Liverpool always said, no, we support him, he's not racist, etc. And even when he's done these biting incidents, you know, fans have supported him. But now it's got to the point where it's on a worldwide scale. It's happened at a World Cup. It's happened in front of millions upon millions of people. Regardless of what Liverpool say or do, they're either going to backtrack and look like idiots, or they're going to support him and look like idiots. So they've not played this well. I mean, they've got a bad apple. He's a great footballer. He's world class. He's fantastic. But, you know, I wouldn't have him at my football club.
So he's a repeat offender, and in my opinion, a worldwide ban is necessary, because it's just unacceptable to go around biting people like a dog. So the worldwide ban is necessary. Are we all agreed on that?
Yeah.
But is the stadium ban necessary? Should he be able to train, like, at, if not with, Liverpool, maybe at the training ground? Is taking him completely out of football too much? Because when he comes back, he will have been training by himself, but you don't get that sort of...
We always want to try and compare football with other jobs. I know it's probably a unique job on its own in terms of a profession, but if we did this in a workplace, you'd probably be suspended without pay for as many months. That means you don't go into the workplace. That means you don't go into work. You don't do anything. So in that sense, yeah, it's fair. He shouldn't be allowed anywhere near football grounds, anywhere near the training ground. So I think it's fair, personally. He needs to be given a severe punishment to really knock him back. If this doesn't do it, then I really don't know what will.
Josh, is the stadium ban necessary? Should be able to train, or is the ban FIFA have given appropriate?
I think what's entirely necessary is some sort of rehabilitation, really. When you're looking at punishments, what the main aim for me is, you know, to stop him from doing it in the future, and to make him learn his lessons. And probably the best way of doing that is sacking him out of football, a game that he as a professional should be in love with and should relish the opportunity to perform, and do what he loves week in, week out. And so, you know, taking that opportunity away from him for a while and sort of getting him to learn from the mistakes he's made, you know, is probably the best way of doing things and handling things. So yeah, I would agree with what you said. Yeah.
It's obviously a massive issue, and Liverpool may take this against FIFA. They'll feel they've been victimised. But we unanimously agreed that it's the appropriate ban. Uruguay are also going to take action. Do you see FIFA backing down after this? Maybe like shortening it to 3 months?
They would be condemned. You've got to remember that the disciplinary committee is independent from FIFA. So it's not FIFA who impose the punishment themselves. It's their own committee who's completely independent and will make their own decisions. But I think if they are going to be threatened with, you know, legal action to the court of arbitration, I think they might say, let's cut it a bit. I think he's actually fortunate that it's come at a World Cup in terms of the timing. He'll be missing 2 months of pre-season. So there's no competitive fixtures at that time. When the season starts, he'll only be missing a month. I mean, he'd only be missing 3 Champions League games, which when you think about that, that's nothing. So in a sense, it should be more, but I think there should be, you know, counting their lucky stars, it's only 4, rather than, you know, trying to argue their defence and trying to lower it.
So obviously we can't have the whole podcast on a dog, but no, we can't have the whole podcast on Suarez, Liverpool and Uruguay. But just a quick one, Costa Rica, they've impressed in England's group and Uruguay's group, of course. How far can they go? Do you think they'll fall at the next hurdle, or can they keep going?
They've impressed me so far. Very disciplined. I think they're playing with 3 at the back and with the wing backs. Has worked extremely well, particularly against Italy. I thought they were so compact and well organised. And going forward, they do look threatening, especially on the counter attack. Ruiz is a player we know well from watching him at Fulham. Technically very good, and Joe Campbell as well has been superb. His movement, his work rate, and his overall game has been superb. So it's they've got a favourable draw against Greece, a side that the hit and miss occasionally. They do have a lot of talent in there, don't they? But you can never see him, doing too well. So I'd expect Costa Rica to win that one. But it all depends on the day. It's as cliched as it sounds. If Greece turn up, and are able to execute the game plan correctly, then used to say they can't do the business. But I think it's going to be quite an interesting game. And it'll be, I think what will be key is getting off to a good start. And we'll see how it goes, but looking forward to it.
So Costa Rica going through for Josh. USA, Aaron, where do you see them going? Not further for now, but obviously Belgium will find the game hard because the US have really impressed against Germany, Ghana and Portugal. But how good are Belgium? Are they good enough, or is this one tournament too early for Mark Wilmots' side?
Difficult question, really, because we've got an exciting crop of players at the moment. When you look at the defenders, they've got good depth there, good pool of players to select from. Kompany, Van Buyten, Vermaelen, Vertonghen, the list goes on. They've got good experienced defenders there. 2 good keepers in Courtois, Mingele. Good midfield options, with the likes of Witsel, Fellaini, Defoe, Dembele, then obviously Hazard's a standout player, but they've also got Januzaj, Chadli, Mertens as well. And then up top, Lukaku is the main man, but obviously Origi came up with the goods the other day. They are a good side, and they're a side of a tip to do well at this tournament, and I think they will progress in CSA. But I think the time when we will see them at their very best will probably in 2 years' time at, in Euro 2016. But they, you know, it's quite a treat to watch them at the moment because they've got such a well balanced squad.
Aaron, so obviously they've got a talented group of players, but up against sides like Brazil and Argentina are really coming into their flow, but we'll discuss that in a second. And Holland, who have really impressed now, how are they good enough, or is 2016 in France or even 2018 in Russia their tournament?
Holland?
No, Belgium.
Belgium. This one has probably come a bit too soon, simply because I think it's the first time they've got there since 2002. It's the first time this group of players have had to experience tournament football. So whatever happens from here on, I think they should take as experience and, you know, they should be proud of themselves because, you know, it is difficult to get out of a group. I mean, people always take it for granted, but at the World Cup, it's difficult because you've got to hit the ground running. You have three games, that's it. Italy, Spain, England, they're all out because they've not hit the ground running. And then you look at teams like Costa Rica and Greece who have gone through. And, you know, albeit with a bit of luck, but you need that luck as well. And I think Belgium need to sort of gain that experience as well to make their own luck and be a bit more streetwise. I think France, 2016, I think they would be up there. But I think it's too far to say for 2018 just yet because I'm sure Spain will evolve. I'm sure Germany will evolve. You have Brazil, you have Argentina. You never know. They might still, you know, if they have the same squad, it doesn't necessarily mean that they'll still be as good. You know, there might be teams that are much better. So it's difficult to predict that far, but I think France 2016, they have a fantastic chance of winning a trophy. I think that would be quite awesome. But I think for this tournament, I think if they get to the quarterfinals, I think that's a very, very good showing for them.
Yeah, obviously we were discussing Holland have really surprised a lot of people with their brilliance under Van Gaal. Along with Colombia and France, are they the sort of real surprises in this World Cup, Josh?
Yeah, it's unusual to tip Holland as a surprise package, especially because they were the finalists in 2010. But with the injury to Strootman and also Van der Vaart being ruled out of the tournament, it is quite strange to see him doing so well. You know, without the presence of them two key players, I think they've adapted really well to the whole system of playing with three central defenders and wing backs. That's worked really well for him. It allowed them to get teams on the count if they've done countless times against Spain. Midfield, they do look, I don't know, disjointed, but that's understandable because Strootman's absent from the side and he's such a crucial player. But they've got De Jong who's always going to break up play, which Naldum has been decent. Snyder, you know, he's not in his prime anymore, I don't think. But he still obviously possesses a lot of quality. They look very, very good going forward. With Van Persie and Robben, always a threat scoring goals, and they have got quite an impressive starting 11. It's just, you know, they are maybe a bit thin in terms of the players coming off the bench and in the squad. But for one thing to show that they'll give any team a game. And, you know, you won't be too surprised, possibly, to see him go all the way, especially you know, with the attacking prowess, shall we say, that they've got.
I think with Holland as well, the best part, I think, is the fact that they've plugged their own weaknesses and played to their strengths. I mean, how many managers would try and fit in players into a certain system? You know, how many managers do you get who are very rigid and will play a specific formation, and if somebody's injured, they won't change the formation, they'll just fit somebody else in and try and make them do a job. Van Gaal's gone in, he's played 4-3-3 majority of his career. He's played 3-4-3 in a similar way with Ajax, and he's gone in and with he's got a tournament coming along and he has the audacity to basically turn around and say, actually, do you know what, we'll play a completely different formation. And he's got along, he's had only 5 weeks with this formation, and they went and battered Spain. I think, without even no bias, I think he is a massive advantage for Holland, because he will not only set up teams to stop other teams, but he will play to his own strengths. And I think, tactically, he is one of the best in the world, and he's never been given enough credit for it. But I do think that the Van Gaal factor, I think the Robin and Van Persie factor, them three people are key to the Dutch hopes, and it would not shock me if they ended up winning it. But I certainly expect them to get to at least the semi-finals there.
Yeah, obviously Van Gaal's done a fantastic job, but also his willingness to... So Van Persie's obviously suspended from the last group stage game, but he didn't play Huntelaar because he didn't feel he fitted... Even though he was willing to change the system, he didn't feel he fitted in his style of football. That's a brave move, because Huntelaar's not one for sort of sitting back and allowing that to happen, is he?
Not really, no. But, you know, it sort of defines Van Gaal as a character and a coach, because shows that he's prepared to make big and drastic decisions, you know, in order to benefit the team. If he feels that Huntelaar isn't the right man for the system, then, you know, it's a decision that he's made, and he's going to stick to it. And, you know, Huntelaar is always a goal threat. He's a really good player in the 6-yard box. But that may hinder other players. And most of Holland's threat, if you like, has come from the counter attack, and I'm not sure whether Huntelaar is the sort of player who's suited for that. He's more suited for crosses into the box and getting on the end of him. And you know, fair play to Van Gaal for grabbing the guts to lead him out.
Yeah, he's done a fantastic job. But we're almost halfway through the podcast, so time to move on to something else. Argentina and Brazil, they haven't, the two big South American countries, they haven't been absolutely fantastic, but, and especially in the first two group games where Brazil drew and 1-1, but Argentina luckily beat Iran. I don't feel they deserve to win that. It was more of a drawing game. And, Argentina have now won all three and Brazil have won 2 and 1-1, but in the last sort of, in the second half of the last group stage game, they both sort of started to click, and it was like a sudden realization that these two teams aren't overhyped. They are, in fact, brilliant. Obviously, Messi is driving that Argentinian team, but his teammates sort of started to get into the groove, if you like, in that last second half. Will the round of 16 really show their quality, Josh?
Most likely. I think first and foremost, Argentina were really disappointed in the first game against Bosnia, when Sabella lined up with a 3-5-1-1 sort of system, and it just didn't work. Then he changed it at half time and they looked a lot more balanced, and they was able to get Messi on the ball a bit more, and obviously it helped him and aided him hugely. Against Iran, they just got over the line, really. You know, with massive help from a little magician who wears number 10. And then against Who did they play? It was Nigeria. Yeah, that's blank. No, they did what's necessary, and they did look a tad shaky at the back. Musa troubled them quite a lot. But they've got that player with Messi who can change a game in an instant. That's something that's always good to have in a team. As for Brazil, I think it was, you know, really lacklustre in the game against Mexico. But against Cameroon, especially when Fernandinho came on, and immediately he sort of bossed the game midfield. You know, they looked a lot more assured and a lot more threatening. And, you know, it's always, the most difficult part is getting out of the group, and now they've, I think they've got what it takes to go on and do well. So I think, you know, they're only just getting started at the moment. They'll find the rhythm thoroughly in the next couple of games.
Yeah, Brazil, Argentina have never started brilliantly in any World Cup, really. They always take their time to click, so it's quite lucky that they were drawn in such a, what was assumed to be an easy group, didn't turn out so easy in the end. But if they'd been in, say, Germany and Portugal's group, where the USA were, I know that probably is extremely unlikely, but if they'd been in there, we could have seen an early exit for them. With the poor performances they showed, you could easily see, as in when they played Iran, USA, if they played against them like that, could easily beat them. So could Portugal could get a draw, and Germany would thrash them. But you say you need that, Aaron said, you need that little bit of luck to win the World Cup. They got that little bit of luck, and do you think they'll win it, Aaron?
Many people thought Argentina would win it, but I think one thing we've seen is they're so heavily reliant on Messi. And yeah, he will get, you know, tricky positions back against Iran, but, you know, they've not impressed me, and they've not given me anything, no evidence to prove that they can actually get better as this one that gets on. Because now it is a knockout game. It's, you know, one bad performance, and, you know, how much can you rely on Messi? I mean, they've sacrificed so much for Messi to play him in his favourite position and try and make him so effective, and it's working. But I think I'd prefer to have Aguero on form as well as Messi. He's not scored. You've got
players. Doesn't look fair at all.
No, and yeah,
he's
that's
now
the thing
out of the Switzerland game.
I mean, you know, they're making. I mean, again, we spoke about Van Gaal with Holland, how he's made a system, you know, that suits everyone. Argentina, they are fitting players into a system. And I think Sabella looks like, even on the touchline, he always looks nervous. And I think they will get through to the semi-finals. But I don't think they'll go further than that, simply because I think they don't have the, you know, quality in the sense. They do look, you know, susceptible to counterattacks. Iran should have beaten them, never mind getting a draw. So, you know, if teams like that can do a job on them, then you imagine if they come up against a Brazil or a Holland, you know, they'll be really struggling.
Yeah, they will be struggling. Obviously, Argentina have got through, but there's a certain team who haven't got through. I think we all know them quite well. That's England. See, the funny thing is, I was having a conversation with my brother today, as I prefer to do this, and I was talking about the England, like, the solution that we have, but we won the under-17 Euros this year, and we didn't only win it this year, but 4 years ago, we won it for the first time, acceptably, but we've just won it twice in a row, and that the squad from last time hasn't really come through. Obviously, you don't expect all 18 of the squad members from your 2010 Euros under 17 to come through. But if I just go through, there's names you recognise, and then there's names you think, and then there's one name that you think, oh, he's done well. And then the others you think, oh, sort of bottom table Premier League, if you're lucky. All right, I'll just go through. Sam Johnston, Bruno Pilatos, Luke Garber, Connor Cody, Nathaniel Chalobah, obviously, Chelsea player, but hasn't done too well. Andre Wisdom at Liverpool, hasn't done too well. Will Keane, United, hasn't done too well. He's sort of making an effect on... He made an effect on Moyes, but didn't get that place. Didn't do that well alone. George Thorne, Benik Afobe, Sadie Berahino, he's done all right. Robert Hall, Ben Gibson, Jack Butland, Tom Thorpe, Josh McEachran, and then there's Ross Barkley, Connor Wickham, and Luke Williams. Ross Barkley is the only player who's made it into the England national team now. And if we're winning the under 17 championship, where's what happens at under 21? What happens at under 19? What's going wrong? What do we need to do? Any thoughts on that?
Aaron, do you want to go first?
You know what it is? You can name quality players. You can, you know, produce as many players as you want. But one thing sometimes you can't coach is a mentality. And I think in this country, we've always emphasised winning and losing from a young age. And I think, I mean, it's fantastic to say, yes, they won the under 17, you know, European Championship or whatever it was. But that might be the only trophy some of those people win. So we shouldn't really be saying, oh yeah, we've won this trophy, it means we're great. Chelsea have dominated youth football in this country, but how many of those players have made the first team? Without opportunity and without emphasis on actually playing and improving, I don't think England will actually succeed. I think this time round they've actually got quality. But I think what I would do is I would make sure that Ross Barkley, Luke Shaw, Jack Butland, and, you know, players, that young group of players that were taken to the World Cup should also be available for the under-21 teams, yeah. The European Championship. Let them have tournament football, let them progress, and let them actually experience and improve against people who are their own age. Because you can't throw players into the deep end like that, even if they're very special. You are almost stunting their development, and if they have a bad experience, it's going to be very difficult for them to get over it. But I think we need to start having an emphasis on progression and development rather than actually winning and losing, especially at such a young age. I think if we were to improve that part of the grassroots game, I think that would eventually stem up to the national team. And, you know, tell me which player was it that said he hated playing for the national team? Was it
actually revealed?
Was it Scholes?
Oh, it might have been, yeah, but, you know, Scholes was, you know, misused massively.
He was misused, but he hated it. And why do you think they hated it? They, you know, the reason they hate it is because there is such an emphasis on them having to win. Now, just because you've got fantastic players doesn't give you the, you know, expectations one thing, but, you know, putting heat for pressure on these people is just not fair because you are hindering them before they've even got there. You can argue that this time around there was, you know, lower expectations, but, you know, it works both ways. Even if you have lower expectations, then you can't slag them off when they come home, you know? I personally think this is a massive experience for them. I think this is probably going to do them better than it will do them if they got to the quarterfinals, say, simply because I think they need that disappointment and they needed to experience playing against a team like Italy and Uruguay and, again, try and hit the ground running. I think it was evident during the warm-up games that England weren't going to do well. They never really got into the groove. I mean, against Team Uruguay, I think they were unlucky. I think the playing style that Hodgson adopted was brilliant. I think, you know, very positive, very un-Hodgson-like, actually. They were just unlucky. And I think it's disappointing that so many people were so disappointed when, really, I was looking at it and thinking, you know what? In Euro 2016, they are going to be dark horses because nobody's going to want to play them. And it's going to be a completely different game because, you know, you don't have these cultural differences. You're going to know the European teams and you're going to know the players. So, you know, there's a lot of positives, I think. Even if they've got knocked out, I think there is a lot of positives. There's no point having the same old argument every single time England go out of a tournament. I think what you need to do is progress. you know, what they did wrong, make it right next time, and just get behind the team again. Doesn't matter if you're disappointed, you have to keep it behind the team. Don't pressure them. Be an asset rather than a hindrance. That's what I think.
Obviously, Chelsea is different. You used an example, but they pay for their players. But what I'm trying to say is, obviously something's going wrong, because if you see, Sam Johnstone was the England keeper for under 17 when we won it in 2010. Obviously, he can't be under 17 now because he was 17 then. He is in the under 21 squad, but, and so is Jack Butland, but we're not seeing these people after they've come into the under 21 squad, because obviously some of them are still in there. They're not coming out, and then even if they go back in the under 21 squad for a bit, they're not then coming back out. There's obviously something going wrong with this, because you can't have this squad of talented players at under 21, and then they sort of get to under 21, and then lots of them from the under 17, lots of the under 21 players are from the under 17s in 2010, but we're not seeing, like, we don't seem to be able to get that these players can come up, and we, like, as in, these players aren't coming up. There's obviously talent in there, because we've seen James Ward-Prowse in there, Berahino, Will Keane, Michael Keane, Johnston, Butland. But where's it going? If it's still going into the under 21s, why isn't it coming back out?
Yeah, I think Stuart Pearce was spot on. What he said in an interview with TalkSport the other day, he was saying that, you know, under 17 level we have been quite successful, but the main factor in that is because we have our best players available for that age group. Now, when they move up to under 19s, under 20s, under 21s, then, you know, that's when your best players, you know, are available. I think a prime example would be the last European Championship that Stuart Pearce was in charge, where Chamberlain and Wilshere, you know, our main promising youngsters, you know, they weren't interested in playing, and that's not right. There's too much of a gap, I think, and we need to, you know, we need to change that. And I think it's just a problem that's from the lower levels. I think with the style that we implement it needs to be altered. Hopefully that is the case. But even still now, when players, you know, young kids, the talented, there's still an emphasis on how tall they are and how tall they will be, how tall the parents are, and that's not right. It's got to be purely on your football ability, your technical qualities, and that's why a lot of these countries are ahead of us at the moment. And, you know, it's a big problem. There's more to it than just our national team being unfortunate at a tournament. It's quite a big problem, but, you know, we are lucky to have so many talented players in our ranks at the moment. We've just got, you know, aid their development as much as we can, and, you know, we'll see how it goes. But I think there are a few positives from this tournament. We need to continue with a positive attacking approach, and, you know, see where it gets us. I'm still unsure whether Hodgson is the right man for the job. But obviously he's being backed. So, you know, we'll just have to see how it goes, but I'd like to see a lot more players make that step up from, you know, the under 17s to the under 21s and then eventually progressing national team, because the gap's too big at the moment. So we need to do something about it.
Obviously we haven't found the solution yet, but obviously we've discussed that. But are we aiming too high, like, now? Because everyone's expecting us to get to the quarterfinals. Maybe some of us aren't, but the majority of England fans and the majority of pundits who are in England assume we're getting to the quarterfinals, assume that is where we should be. If you think about it, we can just list the teams better than us just easily. You've got Brazil, Argentina, Germany, Holland, Belgium, Spain, Chile beat us, Uruguay with Suarez, obviously. Colombia could beat us, France would beat us, Italy would beat us. That's already 11. How are we going to get into the quarterfinals if we've got 11 teams better than us? Obviously, it does depend on the days and the cliche, but we're clearly not the top 8 teams in the world. Why do we assume that we can get to the quarterfinals, which is the top 8 teams in the world?
fairly straightforward, really. I mean, we are seen as one of the elite nations for football. You know, in fact, we are, you know, founders of football to an extent. And, you know, there's always going to be a bit of expectation for us to do well. But quite frankly, there are other teams and other nations that are ahead of us at the moment. And that's mainly down to the fact that they have, you know, there's the style and philosophy is different to ours. There's not so many clubs which are picking players more based on the athleticism than the actual technical quality. And if we don't, you know, there is a lot of talent that we have, but we're misusing them at the moment. And, you know, we've got to change that if we are gonna beat them teams. We need to be able to you know, to play teams like Uruguay. And, you know, we as a nation and all the history we have, you know, such a fantastic league like the Premier League, we should be beating them. And, you know, we're falling behind at the moment, so there needs to be a major rethink, you know, if we are going to strive towards getting back up there with the elite teams.
Yeah, obviously, as with every other subject, we can't talk about this all day. Just quickly, what results have really stood out for you in the group stages? Obviously, Friday the 13th was unlucky for Spain, as they lost 5-1 to Holland. A bit surprised as Uruguay lost 3-1 to Costa Rica. What else has stood out for you in the past 2 weeks or so? Is it 2 weeks? Yeah, 2 weeks. Aaron.
I think more than the results, I think it's the mentality teams have taken on. In South Africa, teams took on a, you know, must not lose mentality. And in this one, teams have had a go, and that's what's made it attractive. You know, there's been more goals at this stage since 2002. And you know, the games, even some of the games that you've not expected to be good have turned out to be good. I mean, I remember watching Switzerland and Ecuador, and the way that turned out, you know, it was fantastic. And you know, the teams have not given up, and I think that's always a good thing as well, rather than, you know, teams sitting back when they're drawing, you know, being satisfied. Teams are having a go and going for it all the way. My favourite game so far has actually been Germany and Ghana. I really enjoyed that.
Me too, that was a cracking game.
Both of them were just having a go at each other. It was like, you have a go, I'll have a go. And, you know, I hopefully it'll carry on. And some of the ties we've got, you know, defensively, some of the teams aren't brilliant. So hopefully some more goals and more open games. But, you know, I think it's difficult to actually pinpoint one great thing. I just think the tournament so far has been so entertaining, and you know, long may it continue.
Yep. Most boring game for you? I think it's fairly obvious. Josh, you first.
Well, Iran Nigeria was a phenomenal game. Lots of action, loads of goals, lots of quality on display. No, it was, unfortunately, it was far from it. That was a really disappointing game. Just looking now at some of the other games, I think Japan, Greece. You know, the game where Socrates was sent off. That was quite a dull affair. Obviously, Greece shut up shop once you know they had the red card. But even Japan, they had obviously the advantage. But they were unable to get in the right areas, and it was frustrating to watch, because when a team loses a player, you know, you're always expecting the initiative to be with the you know, the team that have the advantage, and you know, they were able to make the most of the advantage they have. Now I said advantage a lot there, but we're unfortunate to see a lot of exciting games with high intensity, high tempo. This World Cup, and hopefully in the knockout stages, we won't see any more boring games. Because when you look at the teams, you know, that are into the last 16, you know, you should see quite a few goals in there. So, no more disappointing games, please.
Of course, Iran are out, Nigeria aren't. They could, Nigeria and Greece are the two that are maybe the two disappointments of the next few. Unless you've got anything else to say, I think it's goodbye, is it not?
Seems so.
Alright, thank you for listening, everyone. I'll just bring you a quote from Sampioli. Aaron, you were talking about how the mentality was not to lose. Sampioli just said, Chile has grown a mentality to play without fear. I'll leave you on that. As Jeremy Clarkson says on that bombshell, it's time to say goodbye. Thank you for listening. Come again next time. We should be here after the round of 16. Again, thank you and goodbye.